Welcome back to Question Medicine 2019. I am Andrew Bilt down here in sunny St. Petersburg, Florida. It has been a while since the last podcast, but I've been busy. Been traveling the world and had a chance to go to the Masters. That's right, the Masters here on CBS. A tradition unlike any other. And let me tell you, if you ever get a chance to go, it really is a tradition unlike any other. It is almost like you step into a whole new world that doesn't even... I mean, it's just... Everything is just so... The grass is cut perfectly. The birds chirp just the right amount. I cannot describe it to you. And the pimento cheese sandwiches for $1.50? I mean, come on. I had six of them. I lied. I actually only had five of them. But six of them sounded a lot better. Anyways, I am back. And without further ado, without any hesitation, without any reservation, it is good to be back. All right. Here we go. Let's kick it off. I'm just going to jump right into the studies. The first study is one that I'm not really a big fan of, but I'll let you decide if you are, and I'll tell you why you're wrong if you disagree with me. Just kidding. This was Annals of Internal Medicine, March 5th, 2019, titled Characteristics of High Cardiovascular Risk in 1.7 Million Chinese Adults. Seems like an interesting title when you just read it. The characteristics of high cardiovascular risk in 1.7 million anything is got to be pretty important, right? So in total, this was actually just shy of 1.7 million participants, and they broke you down by your cardiovascular risk disease. You were low, moderate, or high risk. If you were less than 5%, between 5 and 9%, or if you were greater than 10%, respectively. Now, basically, primary prevention, that was all of these people. If you had had a previous heart attack, a stroke, anything like that, you were excluded from the study. But let's back it up just a second. Remember, 10% was considered quote-unquote high risk. I mean, that is when most liberal individuals of the guidelines recommend, well, we should start therapy. And those of us that critically appraise the literature laugh at that number and say, no. And even Canadians say, you're about halfway there, eh? It is probably not a time we should give it. But if you're defining it at high risk for primary prevention, so be it. Anyways, among the over 1.5 million participants, high-risk cardiovascular disease was present in 9.5%. And as you can imagine, the risk went up as you get older, because that's the one risk factor that you just can't fight is age. Now, roughly 1% of those aged 35 to 39 years, all the way up to 31% of those that were age 70 to 75 years. Again, as you get older, your risk goes up. But age wasn't the only risk factor. There were other risk factors that put you at quote-unquote high risk. And what were those, you ask? What were the things that made you at high risk for a major adverse cardiovascular event? Well, it's the same thing you've learned since preschool. Hypertension, dyslipidemia, diabetes, and smoking. And maybe you haven't learned that since preschool, but you've learned all the things that cause that since preschool. Not enough exercise and not eating enough fruits and vegetables. Basically, that's what it boils down to. The most common three risk factor combination was hypertension, diabetes, and dyslipidemia. If you had that triple combination, you had about a 23% chance that you were defined as quote-unquote high risk. Here's where the study gets interesting. Among these people that were quote-unquote high risk, 10% or more, only 0.6% reported taking statins and 2.4% reported taking aspirin. Now, I think we know because of recent studies that aspirin for primary prevention is out the door. We are throwing the baby out with the bathwater. But only 0.6% for individuals that were quote-unquote high risk were on a statin, that just seems crazy to me. It seems like maybe primary care doctors are a little too busy, because one in 200 that are quote-unquote by the guidelines to receive statin therapy, only one in 200 were on statin therapy. I'm not saying that all these people should have been on statin therapy, but that number seems unbelievably low. And I would hate to think that that's the real numbers here if they did 1.7 million people from Florida, but if this prevalence were to be true, of the people that were high risk and only 1 in 200 were actually on statin therapy, because statins do have benefit, maybe small, but they do have benefit, it just seems disappointing, depressing, sad. But what do I know? Because that might be the happiest trial that I'm going to talk about this entire podcast. The next trial I want to talk about is a trial which I learned. It's not even a trial, actually. It's a review. It's a review of all the literature. It is a review of pain medications. This is in Current Pain and Headaches Report. Paper titled, Oxycodone's Unparalleled Addictive Potential is a Time for a Memorandum. If you have a chance to read any article that I talk about, this is the article that you should read, because it's unbelievably fascinating. And if you know a lot about medications, pain medications particularly, then I would encourage you to read this and let me know if it's right. If you don't know a lot about it, then I would encourage you this, because it is eye-opening. Basically, I'm going to break down some of the tips and pearls from this that I learned, and, you know, hopefully you'll learn something as well. The main thing that they talked about in this article was oxycodone. Oxycodone is unbelievable. It was first developed in 1916 as an attempt to provide analgesic medication which could rid us of our use of heroin. Yeah, that's right, heroin. People were using heroin, so like, hey, we'll make this other drug called oxycodone. Unfortunately, over the past two decades, oxycodone has become the opioid with the largest increase in distribution by volume and number of prescriptions. And it is unbelievably addicting for a drug that set out to be the non-addicting heroin. In this paper, they interviewed 86 people. And these people were split into two groups. Those who exclusively used non-heroin opioids, and then those individuals who pretty much only used heroin opioids. And then they asked them some questions. The first question they asked them was, which of these drugs is most desirable to you? And they gave them a whole list of drugs, oxycodone, hydrocodone, morphine IR, extended release, blah, 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 right down the list. They asked them the same question of, question two, which of these is the most desirable drug to use in the community? And then they asked them question number three, which is, which of these is the most addictive? Again, every single time, hydrocodone, oxycodone, morphine, blah, 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 blah. And you might have guessed it correct. When they said, what is the most desirable? Oxycodone, 60% of the time. And we know this because in going through this literature, I found another paper titled Characterizing the Subjective Psychomotor and Physiological Effects of Oral Oxycodone in Non-Drug Abusing Volunteers. So this paper was crazy. They took 18 volunteers and then they randomized them to placebo, oxycodone, either 10 milligrams, 20 milligrams, 30 milligrams, 40 milligrams, or lorazepam. So you either got a benzo, an opioid, or you got nothing. Those that got the oxycodone said, and I quote, because you can't make this kind of stuff up, that the high that they got was, quote, dreamy, calm, the Cadillac of highs. That is right, the Cadillac of highs, if you will. And because it is a Cadillac rolling on 20-inch rims, if you will, the prescription opioid rated by these now drug users, back to these 90 drug users, heroin and non-heroin users, the prescription drug that was rated most addictive by the largest number of participants was, again, oxycodone, 60% of the patients. The next closest was methadone at 15%. The next closest is nowhere inside. It's a quarter of the percent, if you will. Oxycodone is it. And when they asked just the heroin users, what was your gateway drug? What was the drug that made you say, hey, you know what? I think today's a good day to switch to heroin. Well, the answer, oxycodone. 78% of them. Now, the authors don't really have any good answers here as how we can limit this use of oxycodone abuse, but they suggest to limit a script to 7 days and then transfer and taper. But I have a way better idea, and this is going to sound really crazy, but it is, don't give the script in the first place. There is probably no need for oxycodone. You can give them morphine. There's hydrocodone. You can give them all these other drugs, but oxycodone? I don't think so. In fact, since reading this, I have not written for one script of oxycodone. And since reading this, I have asked some of my chronic pain patients, or the patients that come in and they say, oh, I need a pain script. I need this. I need pain script. I say, let me ask you a serious question. What is the best pain medication? If you were going to give just the best pain medication, like maybe not necessarily that you get, but that you've had before, whether you got it on the street or wherever you got it, what would you say that it is? Surprise, surprise. The answer is oxycodone. It was shocking. It was shocking to me. It's probably shocking to you unless you've asked the question and you already knew that. But I encourage you, read this paper. It is in the details of this podcast. If you don't want to read it, that's okay. But start asking your patients, what's the most addictive? Don't say addictive. Which one is the best? And let's just see what they say. Now, this next paper is a little bit more exciting. It's definitely a little bit more exciting and a little bit more positive, but there's always a negative when you read the devil in the details. And that is that Advair Diskus is now going generic. That is right. Get it here. The new name, Winlexa InHub. It'll be $94 for a 100 microgram fluticasone product, all the way up to $153 for a 500 microgram product. Now, this may sound like a lot of money. I mean, you're saying, come on, are you kidding me? $100 for one discus? That seems crazy, and it is crazy. Don't get me wrong, but it's so much better than the almost $270 I found on GoodRx in my neck of the woods and the $521 I found for the 500 microgram product. It's sad, but it's true, and it is good that it is becoming generic. Now, let's look at why it's taken so long to become generic. Because Advair expired back in 2010. So why am I just now talking about it in 2019, almost 9 years later? Well, it wasn't the drug. It was the delivery device. The discus itself did not expire until 2016. And boom, there you go. You must have a delivery device. And creating and patenting your own delivery device is very hard and very expensive. So why reinvent the wheel? Let's just wait until 2016 when the patent expires. Now, I can only hope that this means that Big Pharma is going to run out of some money and they're going to make Advair really cheap, give it away. I'm sure they won't. I'm sure they'll figure out some other way to then patent the Advair just a little bit different with a little bit different disc, send it off to marketing like you wouldn't believe, maybe just change an isomer in there one way or another, come up with a really crummy study on COPD since COPD tends to wax and wane. Anyways, they're only going to publish the good one, give it to the FDA and say, here you go. Look at this wonderful study we did on a disease which continuously wax and wanes as is, and then we'll get our new drug approved. But maybe that's just me being a little pessimistic. And I must say that often I am kind of a naysayer. That's right, I am a naysayer, but this next study is really cool. Probably the coolest thing I'd read in a long time. And let me tell you about it. It is in The Lancet, titled Smartphone-Enabled Video Observed Versus Directly Observed Treatment for Tuberculosis, a Multicenter Analyst Blinded Randomized Control Superiority Trial. Whew. All right. This is pretty cool because, as the title suggests, this uses your smartphone and lets you do direct treatment observation. So let's just go back. If you have, I don't know, something like tuberculosis, you have to have direct therapy. That means you have to get up and you have to go to the clinic and someone has to watch you put a pill in your mouth, and it is terrible. Really, I mean, it's really awful. I can't imagine every day before I go to work, before I do anything, or maybe even at work, I have to have someone watch me take the medication. Now, as you can imagine, the compliance with this is not very good. It's always good at the beginning, right? Everyone gets a new diagnosis and they always want to treat it like you wouldn't believe. But a month later, 2 months later, 3 months later, they start to fall off the bandwagon because life gets in the way. Life is busy and life gets in the way. So in this multi-center analysis that was blinded, randomized control, superiority trial in 22 clinics in England, they took 16-year-olds with active pulmonary or non-pulmonary tuberculosis who were eligible for direct observation therapy, and they put them in the study. And these patients were given a phone and an app. In the app, they could record themselves taking the medication. On video, taking the medication 7 days a week, and then they would just submit the video on the app, and then somebody would watch it in a clinic somewhere, some magical place, and they'd say, oh, look at that. Bill took his medication today. Do it again the next day. You get the point. Or you were randomized to just showing up at the clinic just like you normally would be scheduled to Monday through Friday. And then we just assumed on Saturday and Sunday that you actually took your medication. Now, the primary outcome was a successful completion of 80% or more of the scheduled treatment observations in the 2 months following randomization. If you look at the intention to treat analysis, so those individuals that originally were assigned to that category, 70% of the video treatment individuals successfully achieved the primary outcome, which was, again, greater than 80% scheduled observations. And you may be saying to yourself, 70%? You mean there was 30% of individuals that couldn't take a video of themselves taking the medication every day? I mean, that's not very good. I am sure that the people that had to go to the clinic probably did better, except they didn't. They didn't even do half as good. Only 31% of those individuals that were in the direct observation group completed the primary outcome. Now, I know nothing is perfect because 70% is still not 100%, but this is a huge step up in compliance of treatment. And although both arms started off with high observation rates, like I said, when you first get diagnosed with anything serious, you are so serious about it. You're never going to miss an appointment until life gets in the way. The video group, the app, the cell phone group continued their high rates of observation, while those in the direct observation group started to rapidly fall off. I thought that this study was super cool, and I sent it to one of the pharmacists that I work with. And I said, look at this study. This is amazing. We should be doing this. And then I found out something really awesome. My hospital already does this. They do this for their PrEP patients. Yes, the HIV or the HIV treatment patients. That way, the patients don't have to come in to get their observation of treatment. They can just send it in through the cell phone app. That is pretty cool. All right. This next study that I want to talk about is a rare group of patients. In fact, not really a rare group of patients. They're a rare group of humans. It's those individuals that lose weight, keep weight off, and continue to keep weight off. They're the weight loss maintainers instead of the weight loss regainers. This paper comes in the Journal of Obesity Society, March 2019. It's titled Physical Activity, Energy Expenditure in Total Daily Energy Expenditure in Successful Weight Loss Maintainers. These people are kind of like unicorns. When you find them, you must capture them so you can study them. Now, these weight loss maintainers that were in this study had to have at least a weight loss of 13.6 kilograms, or basically 30 pounds of weight loss, and then have kept that weight off for 1 year. Now, anyone who's ever lost weight knows that if you lose 30 pounds and you can keep it off for a solid year, you're doing something right, because a lot of people can lose 30 pounds. Not a lot of people can keep it off. And so they used this small group of individuals. They used a group that was normal weight controls, which had a BMI that was pretty much identical to these weight loss maintainers, but these normal weight people just were never overweight to begin with and had no history of obesity. And then they finally used a third group, which was the obesity or overweight group that had a much larger BMI. Their BMI was about what the weight loss maintainer's weight was before they lost the weight, so about 30 pounds overweight. Now, the objective of this study was to compare the physical activity energy expenditure and the total daily energy expenditure in successful weight loss maintainers with that of the normal weight group and that of the obese weight group. One of the main reasons that you're looking at this is that it's believed that as you lose more weight, it actually becomes harder to then lose or maintain your same weight. Because when you're 900 pounds, taking one step might burn up 5 calories. But if you're only 100 pounds, taking one step probably isn't even burning half of a calorie. Because it's just not as much energy that's having to be used in order to do the same amount of work. That is, the more you lose, the more you have to move, because you are not burning as much with your movement, and you're not burning as much when you're at rest. It takes a lot more energy to carry around that extra weight. So I think you get the picture of it. Now, here's what they did. It was really cool. They took this thing called the ActivPal monitor. They put it on their thighs, and it monitors all your movement while you're sitting, while you're standing, while you're walking. And patients were asked to wear this device continuously, nonstop. Don't take it off, not to shower, not to go to the bathroom, not to have sex. Just continuously wear this monitor for 7 straight days. So going to the results, the physical activity energy expenditure in the weight loss management group was significantly higher than that of the normal group and that of the obese group. In fact, it was about 200 to 300 kilocalories per day higher, meaning they were burning more calories, physical activity. They were moving more because they were burning 200 to 300 more calories. And because of that, those individuals in the weight loss group, their total daily expenditure of energy, so all the energy they're using all day long to sit there, to just sleep there, to eat there, to go to the bathroom there, when they're not doing anything, was higher than those in the normal group, the individuals that had never lost and never needed to lose weight because they were never obese to begin with. But it was no different than those in the obese group, meaning that those individuals that were obese and then lost weight were burning about 300 calories more per day than their propensity matched individual who had the same BMI as them, who had never needed to lose weight. They were burning 300 more calories a day, and those 300 calories were because of physical activity. Now, one can only assume that physical activity has to be actually more moving of your physical body, because their total energy expenditure was the same as the obese group, but the obese group was using a lot more calories to burn just during routine daily sitting there trying to use their diaphragm to breathe, trying to just sit there, lay there, be calm and still. While the now skinny group, the weight loss maintainers who had lost 30 pounds and kept 30 pounds off, the reason that they were burning as many calories as the obese group is because they were doing physical activity to burn their calories instead of just sitting there like the obese group was. There's a reason that the obese group stays obese, and it's probably because they're not moving, where these weight loss maintainers have changed their lifestyle in some way in which they are now burning the same amount of calories, but they're doing it by moving. And one could argue that, well, maybe it's actually that they're having to move because they're eating so much more, because they're eating 300 calories more than what the normal group is. And there's a reason that the normal group is normal, because they never had an eating problem. Yeah, we could argue all that. Absolutely. There's a lot of different answers here, but I think the bottom line is, if you are obese or overweight and you lose weight, it is a battle to keep it off. And it appears from this study that one of the ways to keep it off is to keep moving. Keep moving, keep moving, and increase your daily physical expenditure. All right, it has been over 20 minutes, but it's been a while, so let's do one more. Let's do one more. Here we go, BMJ. It is a paper that is titled, my favorite title of all titles, The Duration of Antibiotic Treatment for Common Infections in English Primary Care, Cross-Section Analysis and Comparison with Guidelines. Now, as the title says, this basically says, listen, how often are you using antibiotics appropriately compared to guidelines? And then how often are you using for the correct duration of time? This was almost a million, yes, a million antibiotic prescriptions that were reviewed for several indications, such as acute sinusitis, acute sore throat, acute cough and bronchitis, pneumonia, acute exacerbation of COPD, and acute otitis media, acute cystitis, acute prostatitis, pyelonephritis, cellulitis, impetigo, scarlet fever, and gastroenteritis. Whew. Now, I'm not going to sit here and debate whether all those need antibiotics. Which, in my opinion, they don't actually at all. But like acute otitis media, come on. But who am I to say? Who am I to say? They're just saying, let's just go by the guidelines and see what happens. So during the time frame from 2013 to 2015, primary outcome was the percentage of antibiotic prescriptions with a duration exceeding the guideline recommendation. Guidelines say give 5 days, and you say, meh, here's 7 days. Then you fell into the bad group or the no-no group. Now, antibiotics for upper respiratory tract indications in acute cough and bronchitis accounted for more than two-thirds of the total prescriptions. And 80% or more of these treatment courses exceeded guideline recommendations. Out of nearly a million visits that resulted in antibiotics being prescribed, a staggering, ready for this? 1.3 million extra days of antibiotics were given. 1.3 million days of extra antibiotics, and that is assuming that all these prescriptions were actually justified. And again, I'm not going to get into the details whether I think that a mild bronchitis actually needs an antibiotic, but who am I? This is just saying 1.3 million days, and that's probably on the low end. The moral of the story here is check your guidelines. If you don't know your guidelines, look up your guidelines. Longer is not better, it's just longer. A longer course of antibiotics doesn't mean you're doing better by your patient. Ugh. With that little tidbit, with that little gem of knowledge, let's end this thing like I have ended every podcast before it. So here we go, in 30 seconds or less, let's recap all the papers that I've talked about so far. Here we go, starting it off. 10% risk is likely not that high of a risk, and not everyone deserves statin therapy, but certainly out of about 1.8 million people, over 6% or 0.6%, excuse me, of the people deserve to be on statins. So don't forget about statin therapy. It is there. It does work, just not as well as we all probably wish that it would work. Oxycodone. Oh, yes. It is the best of all. It is the high of highs. It is the Cadillac, if you will. But it is also how people get addicted to heroin. So I am not writing for it, and I wouldn't recommend that you do either. Smartphones are actually being smart now, and we can use them instead of direct observation therapy. This is a game changer. Why we aren't doing this for everything, I have no idea. I mean, you can hire a high schooler, a grade schooler, to watch somebody take a video of their medication. This is awesome. Next, if you lose weight and you want to keep it off, then you better keep on moving. Keep on keeping on what you're doing. Because that seems to be the secret to these magical unicorns that can lose 30, 40 pounds and keep it off for over a year. And last but not least, don't be that provider. Don't be that guy. Don't be that person that writes for an extra 1.2 million days of antibiotics. If you don't know your guidelines, look up your guidelines. If you do know your guidelines, then hopefully you wrote your guidelines. And if you have a chance to write your guidelines, have them say that less antibiotics are better antibiotics. There we go. That is a wrap. That ends it all. And I think I hear the music. Yep, there it is. Okay, here we go. I'm going to end this podcast as I have ended every podcast before it. Until next time, keep the quest in questioning.